You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Sometimes I like to do this lower register voice. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, you kind of change it up every once in a while.
Yeah, sometimes I go, you're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. It's like, hey, I'm having a good day. How are you guys? And then I'm like, you're listening to Inside of You. I'm like, which one do you like, dude?
I think I like the first one because the last one you seem sad.
How about, you're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum?
It's like you have something in your throat.
Rob, I just got back from Paris and Ireland. I'm a little tired. It was a 24-hour flight. I mean, it was 24 hours, like, you know, flying and all that stuff. Anyway, we've got a great guest today.
Do you want to talk about
Camille Nanjiani? Flight? Well, we could talk about my flight, but they harassed me a little bit. They gave me a cavity, not a cavity search, but a full body search. You know,
asked for the cavity.
Well, I like exchanged money and they're like, where'd you get this money? I'm like, I literally looked at them. I go, from me, why do I have to tell you where I got my money? Camille Nanjiani is a gifted actor, gifted comedian, funny guy, great writer, has a great story, Oscar-nominated movie for best screenplay, I believe, Big Sick, Big Sick, which was one of my favorite movies of the year. If you haven't seen it, I'm not kidding. The Big Sick is one of my favorite movies. He's also in Silicon Valley.
Which is one of my favorite
shows. One of your favorite shows.
I don't think.
And Natalie.
You haven't seen like
I've seen like two episodes.
That's pretty rude.
No, it's not. I don't have a lot of time. Actually, I don't.
You have too much time.
I do. Anyway, Camille Nanjiani, let's get inside of this guy. You're going to like this.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
So you're a horror movie fan.
Big fan, yeah.
And you're saying Mandy's good.
Yeah, I loved Mandy. I thought it was great.
Don't give anything away, though. It's just intense. Is it? Let me ask you this. Is it scary at all, or is it just violent and fun?
I don't really get scared.
I do. If it's the right movie, it's rare.
Yeah, I like Hereditary. I was really scared in. It's not like that. Like, to me, those movies, it does a great job of ratcheting up tension, but then the release is very, like, intense and over the top. So it's creepy. It's not really scary. I don't think it's really trying to be scary, but it's surprising and pretty over the top.
Did you see The Loved Ones?
No, I did not. I know of it. I know of it.
That.
Is that the one about those people, like they're like cheerleaders or something? Is it that one?
No, it's the movie about the girl who kidnaps the guy to go to prom with her.
Right. I knew it was a prom thing.
I haven't seen it. I loved it. It's a great little indie that was overlooked by a lot of people in the horror.
Yeah, I saw it. It always pops up in my recommendations.
Yeah. Hereditary, I felt, was too long. It was scary. It had its moments. The ending, I wish they would stop doing these movies where, you know, it's a cult sort of like seance at the end of all these horror movies. Like, we get it. We've done that before.
They do it a lot, but I did like that they really committed to it. Like, that movie goes...
I gave it a B minus.
Okay,
and that's good for me because I don't like. I'm very very strict on the grading system.
Okay, I really really loved it just because that sequence in the car. You know what I'm talking about when he's driving
with the sister.
That made me feel.
That was unbelievable.
I haven't had a movie make me feel like that in a long time. So just for me, that scene for me makes it great. Like for me, if I see a movie and there's like one scene in it that like. Really gets inside me, then that's, you know.
Well, guess what? I'm going to be inside you. Camille Nanjiani, thank you for allowing me to be inside of you today.
Thank you for being inside of me.
Well, not quite yet. Maybe just a little.
Okay.
This is exciting. How did we meet? Was it not at Yarvo?
Yeah, I'm sure it was at Yarvo and Autumn's, and, you know, we sort of have friends in common.
We do, but we haven't talked a ton.
No, we haven't really talked a ton, yeah. But I see you around at those. Things.
You're like that guy. That guy.
Yeah, we said hi to each other.
Well, did you think that when you saw me, that guy?
I was like, I was that guy. No,
it's that guy. Yeah, I never want to be that guy. I think there was times when I was that guy, just trying to be. But I don't.
What do you mean
much.
That guy? What do you mean?
You know, when you go to a place and you're like, some guy walks out and he's talking to people and that, and you're like, oh, that guy.
No, you seem always very nice and normal. You're not that guy.
Normal, I take offense.
I mean it as a compliment.
Are you normal?
In the grand scheme of things, I am normal, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, in the sense that I don't think... That I feel pretty together. I'm a pretty together person. I'm normal in the sense that you can put me in most social situations and I'll be I won't weird people out.
Is that because of your family? Do you think you get that a lot from your family, or is it the opposite? Is your family very warm? Are they very, you know, your upbringing, your developmental stage as a child, were you always outgoing? Were they outgoing? Did you think it reflects you now, who you are now?
My dad was very outgoing. My mom is still very shy. I was very, very, very shy until college, like extremely, extremely shy. Like my family's shocked that I do what I do. My friends from high school are shocked. A few friends I had, I'm still in touch with, are shocked that I do what I do. I was very, very shy, and now I'm very outgoing.
I mean, how could the shyest guy in school growing up now be a huge stand-up comedian, actor on one of the biggest shows, wrote and starred in your own movie?
Yeah.
I mean, that's going from the sublime to the ridiculous, my friend.
I think it's sort of like where you get energy from. Do you get energy from being alone, or do you get energy from other people?
Other people.
Yeah, and I think I still probably get energy from... It depends. Sometimes I need energy from being alone and from my wife, and then sometimes I do need energy from being around other people. So it's kind of both.
Yeah. I mean, what was childhood like? Because you were born in Pakistan.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, do you remember it a lot? How old were you when you moved?
I was 18 when I moved. So
you remember it.
I do remember it. Yeah. That would be horrible. I don't know what happened, but I don't remember a fucking thing. I don't want to go to a psychiatrist. I don't want to open this door.
Come on. We just want to know what happened the last 18 years.
I remember waking up in Des Moines at the age of 19 and being like, whoa.
Now that's a horror movie.
Yeah, that's a horror
movie. Waking up in Des Moines. That should be the title of your next movie, Waking Up in Des Moines.
I did. Yeah, yeah.
What do you think of that title? Isn't that a great title?
Have you ever been to Des Moines?
I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like Des Moines?
I don't really know Des Moines. I was in a small town in Iowa called Grinnell, but Des Moines was the airport you fly into.
Now, Pakistan, explain like what it was sort of like growing up there and then moving to the States.
Well, so I grew up in Karachi, which is like the biggest city in Pakistan. It's sort of like New York, but bigger. It's like 20 million people. It's huge. So it was like, you know, I grew up in a very, very urban city environment. And that's still the environment I love. Like, I kind of want to move back.
You like the city life.
Yeah, I want to move back to New York. Whenever I go to New York, I'm like, oh, this is the best.
Why? Why do you like big cities?
I just like being surrounded by people like that, and I just feel a lot more engaged. Like, here, I'm okay now, but when I first moved here, it can be very easy to sort of disengage from life and just hang out in your house, and then you get in a car, and you're in your own bubble. You know, you're sort of like, it's very easy to retreat from society in L.A., whereas in New York, you're forced to be around other people. You got to take the subway. You see all kinds of people. When I was in New York, I just felt very engaged, and I was writing more than I ever wrote in my life. I was just like always like really going. Whereas in LA, I have to force myself to do that. It's easy to get lazy. It took me a little while to figure out how to always be productive. I think I figured it out, but I had to put rules on.
But, you know, for me is, you know, my whole family's from New York. My dad lives in New York.
In Manhattan?
In Manhattan. I lived in New York after college. And I loved it. And I said I'd never move from New York. And then I moved and I hated LA for the first year or two. Then I found the friends. Then I found the places to be, to go, to the hikes, all these. To me, when I'm in New York, I feel I'm claustrophobic.
Uh-huh.
It's like you walk outside, people, buses, cars, trash. Hot. It's too fucking hot. It's too fucking cold. I call my dad and he's complaining about too hot, too cold. And I feel like winter is 9 months long in New York. I think things never end. It just drives me crazy. Everybody's like, well, your parks. Well, we go to Central Park. There's a couple of Central. To me, it's too much. Like, I like being in LA so I could just go to a park that's 5 minutes away. I could go to the beach. I could go for a hike. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I love LA too. It's definitely my second favorite place I've ever lived. And my wife definitely prefers LA because she's from like a small town in the South. So this is more her speed. But I understand that. I didn't realize how stressful life was in New York until I moved to LA and it had been a few months. And I was like, oh, that's what that feeling was on my shoulders all the time. But I do also like it. And the winter, you know, I lived in Chicago for many years. So that is brutal. New York winters are, I know it gets bad, but much easier than Chicago. Chicago winters. It's also, you know, Chicago, the public transportation system is not that good. In the L, the trains are like elevated, so you're waiting like a half hour, three stories up in the air with just like winds from Lake Michigan going right to your bones, you know. So New York winters, I can handle.
We don't have hurricanes, though, in Chicago.
But how often is that an issue in New York? It's just, yeah. It's been a couple times recently.
Yeah, one hurricane hits and he's just freaking out over it. Well, maybe two. Three, pop. Maybe. Yeah. Three hurricanes.
When was that big one where everybody lost power? Like 2-3 years ago in New York?
I think it was like 4 years ago.
Yeah, my family lost...
What?
All the... There was like a big hurricane.
They lost their what?
Just power.
Oh, okay.
They didn't...
That sounded like it was going in a bad place.
Yeah, I was going to be very nonchalant. My brother died, but I'm fine with it. Haven't dealt with it yet.
That was a bad hurricane.
2011.
That was a bad year.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do like it here. I do love living in LA. All my friends live here, you know, but when we lived in New York, we had no money, like zero money. So I want to know what it's like to live in New York and be able to sort of afford living
when
in New York.
When you and Emily lived there?
Yeah, we moved there in 2007.
And you had no money.
It was so, so stressful.
How much was rent?
Rent was like almost $2,000.
And what were you doing to make money?
So Emily had a job. Emily was a therapist then. So she had a job that was, you know, paid very, very little. And I was kind of just doing open mics and stuff, making money.
So just like the movie.
Just like the movie. Like
The Big Sick, which you're here because, first of all, I like you and you're extremely talented. But I tell James Gunn and a couple of us were having dinner. I'm name dropping. But we're having dinner and we were talking about The Big Sick is probably one of our favorite movies from last year.
Oh, thank
you.
It's
like, if not the best movie. And you know, so you're when you watch that, you're like, okay, this is an amazing love story. It's an amazing, you know, it's like that movie Once. You know, it's just this amazing,
love that movie.
Amazing love story that you don't see that when it's real, it's something special. It's something that everybody can relate. Like they go, oh my gosh, this is real. This is tangible. This is not Hollywood. But how much was Hollywood? How much that movie?
Yeah.
It was probably hard to keep it exactly how it happened.
It's not exactly how it happened, but I will say that all the parts, in the important ways, it is very, very shocking.
Emotionally.
But even in emotionally, yes, but also in the stuff that happens, it is pretty shockingly close to what happened. If anything, we, like in real life, you know.
Ray Romano's Emily's father.
we changed the characterizations of some of the people, but the events are pretty close. A lot of the scenes between Emily and I are pretty much from our life, from us, like, hanging out together. The way we met in the movie, she heckled me, that is how we met. So it's pretty shocking how close it is. But then, you know, you got to like structure it as a movie and you take out things that don't make sense and you add in things.
Well, what about your parents? I mean, were your parents sort of like, did they like how they were portrayed?
It's a complicated question. My dad loves the movie. My mom loves it, but I think probably has a little bit more of a complicated relationship with it. Because in watching the movie, I think she saw herself the way I saw her during all of that.
Which was a little bit too strict.
Well, you know, and I understand, honestly, in writing the movie and writing my mom's lines, I understood her perspective for the first time. Like, having to write her as a character and get inside her head made me see her perspective a lot more intimately. I completely understand her point of view.
Did you ever call her up and go, hey, I wrote this line tonight. I just want to see if you'd say it. Like, would you actually say this line?
Well, a lot of her lines were actually taken from stuff she said. She actually visited set, and there's like a little funny scene. And while we were shooting it, I heard my mom laughing really hard in the other room. She ruined the take, and I was like, Mom, what's going on? She's like, we had that conversation. I'm like, oh, yeah, that is right. Like, you know, because it took us so many years to write it, I sort of forgot. I was like, oh, yeah, this scene is a conversation that my mom and I had.
Jeez. All right, so take me back, man. Take me back to Pakistan. You're a shy kid. You're, what are you doing in grade school, in high school? Were you misunderstood? Were you just shy? Were you smart?
I was smart. I always got good grades. I studied a lot and I watched a lot of movies and played a lot of video games. There were like years of my life where I watched a movie every day. I go to the rental store, get seven movies, watch a movie every day.
Why do you think you did that? Was it escape? Was it something in the back of your head that was like, I want to do this? Was it even...
I don't think doing it was part of... That did not seem like a possibility. You know, you watch these movies. I mean, that's kind of the cool thing is, like, you watch these movies and you think these people are, like, gods. And then you start doing it and you're like, oh, they're just people who, like, worked really hard or whatever. You know, it's exciting. I just loved movies and I loved video games. And I think part of it was escape. I think I was pretty well adjusted. I just didn't like school at all. And I just was kind of a loner. And I loved watching movies.
A loner. Movies. Like, you had no friends, or you just have one guy that you remember that you used to hang out with?
I always only had like two or three friends that I was pretty close with.
Do you ever talk to them now?
I haven't seen them in many, many, many years, but they got back in touch with me sort of, you know, in high school, the three or four friends I had, they got back in touch with me, and now I text with them all the time, but I haven't seen those guys in many, many, many years.
How would you feel seeing them again?
I'm excited to see them again.
You would?
I want to. Yeah, because, you know, high school was pretty rough for me, but those guys were great.
Why was it rough?
I just got bullied a lot.
You did?
Yeah, and I was the kid. I was pretty shy, but up until, like, 11th grade. So we have, like, 13 grades over there, basically. So up until the 11th grade, I was, like, the nerdy kid that wasn't on anybody's radar. And when I was on their radar, like, generally people liked me. Even the bad kids, like, liked me. But I was mostly invisible, which was fucking perfect. And then I went to a different school my last 2 years, and I was not invisible. And it was pretty awful. And I mean,
did they physically assault you?
No, just emotional violence. It was really pretty bad.
Well, give me an example. What would you go through?
Like, the worst one was probably there was a kid. I've told this story before, but there was a kid who sort of was a friend. We'd sort of become friends. Like, he'd been at that school longer. And I would help him with his homework and stuff, so he knew where I lived. And then one day, like, I was home alone, and my doorbell rang. And I opened it, and it was that guy. And then a car pulled up, and all the bullies from high school were there, and they threw eggs at me and my house. So this guy, who was my friend, kind of sold me out to, like, the cool kids. And they're like, and then I had to, like, clean the eggs off my clothes and off the driveway before my parents got home, so I wouldn't have to explain to them what was going on.
Because you're embarrassed?
Like, yeah, and I was, like, 17 years old, you know? I'm like, I'm not a little kid. Like, it's fucking embarrassing to have eggs on your clothes when you're 17.
How do you deal with that? I mean, did you cry?
I didn't cry. I just was destroyed.
Did you think of killing them? Did you honestly think, I'm going to find a way to kill them?
Not kill them, but I do still dislike them very intensely. I'll run into people who are like, hey, I know this guy. And I'm like, what was it?
I think you thought of killing them.
I don't think I thought. I would have.
You can say that now.
I wanted to beat them up real bad.
Did you want them to die?
I wanted them to be humiliated. Death was too easy. I wanted everything to be taken from them.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was for no reason.
I mean, it sucks that they never paid for it.
They did. Let me tell you something.
They're probably living
karma crazy. Is a bitch, my friend. I think that was in the movie The Last Boy Scout.
Is that right?
Did he say,
yeah,
karma's a bitch or life's a bitch? Look it up. That's Rob's here. Have you talked to Rob yet?
Hey, Rob. How's it going?
Doing good.
Rob from Chicago.
From Chicago.
See, I'm a good listener.
Rob's he's together. Can you just tell this guy's together?
Yeah. Do you feel together?
No.
You don't? What do you mean?
Oh, man. You stumped me here. I think I'm striving to be together. I think that no one's ever perfectly together.
Right. But
I'm missing things in my life.
Okay, sure.
I'd like to find someone I can enjoy life with all the time.
Sure.
Not just Rob or some friends or, you know.
I know what you mean.
My assistant Jess, who I pay to be my friend. I have a good life. I do fun things. I do great things. I think I'm a good person.
Yeah.
But am I together? No, there's certain things I do that I'm like, why don't you do that? Or why don't you enjoy that more? Why can't you be more present here? Why are you distracted? Sure. Why can't you just let things go?
Yeah.
Why can't you just be? And that's all part of Zen and shit. And I don't know. Are you together?
Am I together? I feel fairly together. I certainly have times where I feel unmoored and floaty. Like last year, there was a lot. You know, it was great. Our movie came out and it did really well. And
it's $40 million last year, right?
Yeah.
Biggest independent movie of the year.
It made, you know, we made it for five and it made like $42 million or whatever.
Did you have a piece of that?
We didn't really make a lot of money on it, but that's okay. The people who took the risk.
Well, you're not living in a, you know, worrying about rent in New York now.
No.
Okay.
I'm doing okay.
But you have another show.
But from that movie, right. Yeah, we didn't really do much money, but that's okay. The producers and the money people are the ones who took a risk and we got to, you know, have our dreams come true.
Absolutely.
So it's pretty great.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
I feel pretty together, but I do know that it's something that takes intention. Being together isn't something that I just am. I know that I have to work at it and be aware of my pitfalls and the things that make me feel not together. So I have to have the things in place that allow me to feel together.
Structure.
Yeah, I'm big on structure. So my days are, unless I'm working, which obviously imposes its own structure, but if I'm not currently working, I do have to have structure. Yeah, I have a schedule every
what
day.
Kind of schedule would that be?
So I wake up in the morning.
What time?
Generally, I like to be up right around 8, but...
Now, how many hours do you need?
7.
7 hours of sleep.
I do need 7. But if I'm, like right now, I'm probably waking up a little bit later, like 8:39, and I'm not too hard on myself over that.
Okay.
But dude, I have to, you know? I mean, when I first moved to New York, I didn't have a job, and Emily had a job, and my life was a mess. I'd be up till 4 or 5 a.m. playing video games. It was...
Did she... I mean, yeah, she probably...
She was like, what are you doing? I'm like, we actually... sort of had to readjust our relationship and I had to readjust my life because of our time in New York pretty directly. I had to impose strict rules on my life. We came up with rules for our life, which are pretty surprising for people.
What are those rules?
So the one rule that we have that is pretty surprising is...
Still,
is Emily and I go to bed at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah, every day.
What if you have to learn lines for Silicon Valley?
So if I have to be up at 4 a.m., I'm going to bed at 7:30.
And she'll go with you?
Yeah, and it, you know, it used to be good for her because she had a day job and I didn't, so I'd be going to bed at, you know, 11 p.m., and now she pays for it. But it's a rule that we've had for, we've been married 11 years, and we've had this rule for probably about, what was it, 2009, like 8 or 9 years.
That's incredible. Could you imagine, Rob, when you go to bed, Natalie goes to bed, you join her?
We go to bed around the same time.
Ugh.
Obviously, there are, you know, if I, like I'm out or we usually go out together, but if I'm out and she's home, but I would say
90%.
95%. 98%. If you said to me, when was the last time you didn't go to bed at the same time? I don't think I could come up with it.
This is remarkable. To imagine that, where you're like, oh my gosh, I want to see this new movie tonight. It's on Netflix. I'm going to watch. And she's like, oh, I'm really tired.
Yeah.
Then, oh, I guess I'm not watching that movie.
Yeah.
Or you watch it while she sleeps.
No,
in bed.
No, you have
in
to
bed.
Sleep, right?
No
watching.
Yeah, is the rule you're going to bed at the
no,
same time?
No, if I was like, I'm going to watch something on my iPad, it would be okay, but I've never done that. I don't like to watch movies on computers or iPads. I want to watch it on my TV.
This doesn't mean you'll make love every night.
No, this doesn't mean that we make love every night.
That'd be crazy. Could you imagine?
Because it's like... sometimes we just fuck. Well, this is what it is, right? So our relationship is very important to us, and it's the most important thing in my life. It's the thing that's most important to me and that allows me to do everything else that I'm able to do, that I feel very lucky to be able to do. It is the thing that allows me to do that. And so we were like, you know, relationship isn't something that just happens. A relationship requires work, and it requires constant intentionality. And so we talk about our relationship a lot, and we've had to adjust it.
Do you go to therapy at all?
No. No therapy.
Have you ever gone to therapy?
I've never gone to therapy.
Really?
Yeah. I know I should go, but I know there are certain things I need to work on. But Emily was a therapist, so it's not like she's my therapist.
Does she let you know it, though? Like, I know this. This is the behavior of...
Oh, yeah. Like, in the beginning, you know, when we were dating, I would get angry and not know why, and she'd be like, you're not angry at me because of this. You're angry at this other thing. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess that's right. Living with her, being in a relationship with her, has really made me understand myself in ways that I never understood myself. And obviously, there's work to be done, but she really... And then, of course, you know, if we're in fights and she's like, you're doing this. And I'm like, don't fucking psychoanalyze me. And I hate it because I know she's right.
Really?
But yeah, so we had to sort of put in rules to just make sure that our relationship was strong.
And what's good. Another rule? Nothing as big as that. Nothing can top that rule.
That's a big one.
That's a big one, man.
I don't know anyone who has that rule. And I don't know anyone who isn't surprised or shocked when they hear that rule.
But it's not other rules like, hey, I'm going to... snort a line of coke tonight, so you have to.
No, but we generally that would be a good rule. I mean, another rule that is a work rule, because we do work together, is that, because it can become very easy to just have your work life and your love life sort of flow into each other, and you don't want to do that. So a rule we have is that if we're working on something together, you know, so we're like writing something together, you know, if we're hanging out and watching a movie and I get an idea for it, I have to ask her permission to bring it up. I have to be like, hey, can we talk about work stuff? And if she says no, then that...
You have to hold on to that thought?
It's non-negotiable. I'll write it down. Yeah.
So you get mad or no? There's no getting mad. You just don't do it.
You just don't do it. We've had that rule for not as long as the sleeping
room. Has it ever been implemented in a way like you're like, I got this idea, and you're like, sorry.
Or did it come because you did it too much?
It came because I did it too much.
Was it? And it was you?
It was me.
Because you were always coming up with things.
Well, because Emily's very good at boundaries and I'm not. I get obsessed. If I'm writing or something, I think about it all day, every day. My life is that. Whereas Emily is very good, first of all, at multitasking. She can like switch gears. She can work on multiple things at the same time. And she's very good at like, all right, it's 6 p.m. I'm not going to check my email anymore. And I am going to, this is me time.
Really? 6 p.m., no more emails.
I'm not good like that. I'm like at 10 p.m. texting. If I'm like working on a movie coming up, I'm texting the director at 10 p.m. I'm not good at those boundaries. She's very good at that. I get very obsessed with the things I'm working on and I can't stop. Whereas she's got a more healthy relationship to work than I do.
You know, maybe that's an important thing to do. Maybe after 6 o'clock, I turn my phone off.
Well, you know, you still want to talk to your friends and stuff, maybe.
Yeah, you still need to use Tinder.
I'm not on Tinder.
Or what are you on?
Well, I have one dating app.
Raya?
Yeah, that's Raya.
Fuck both of you. I mean, look, I don't even know why I'm on it because it doesn't even work.
But if you want to, if you want to date Michael, go on Raya.
No. Look, if you want to date Michael and we connect on Raya, I would say, you know, if I say, hey, how's it going? Respond. Why the fuck are you on Raya? You know, these people, you respond, you know, and you connect, and nobody ever responds. Everybody's too cool. You have to play a game. We're on an app. You connected. Connect.
The whole point of the app is that you don't play the game. Be direct.
These fucking jokers.
If you want to talk, let's talk. If you want to hang out, let's hang out. Let's see what it is. Yeah.
You just hit a nerve. Can you see that?
I am so sorry.
Well, you didn't do it on purpose, but it when I think about that, it's just like it's garbage. People are garbage. It's like, you know, if you don't connect with someone,
right,
or immediately delete me.
Right.
Just delete me.
Or just be like, you know what? Don't
change my mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I changed my mind.
I looked at your Instagram. You're an idiot. You're in your underwear. I don't like your physique.
It's going to be so strange now to date.
You're lucky.
You can like Google and find out everything about the person.
This is why I'm not together.
Yeah.
No, this is why I'm not together.
I'm sorry.
You're married. Rob here is 29 and married and a kid.
You have a kid.
Mm-hmm. Little, almost 2-year-old.
And you love this kid.
Yeah, he's pretty great.
You love this
kid. And how does he feel about you? You're growing on him?
I mean, he's still kind of a little blob, but yeah, he likes me.
Yeah.
Oh, you're getting inside Rob.
Cool.
You guys having a kid soon?
No, we don't have kids.
Do you want a kid?
I don't know.
How old are you?
I'm 40.
That's not old.
I don't know if I want a kid. I just feel like we really like our lives. And I don't know if we're like really looking to change that right now because we just have a good time. I don't know.
I like that.
I've never really like, you know, when I was a kid, the things I loved or when I thought of my life, I always assumed I'd have a kid. But then when I really thought about it, it wasn't really something that was important to me. That doesn't mean I won't have a kid. And obviously, hopefully then it will be important to me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you don't want to have a kid and be like, oh, God, huge mistake.
Here's dad talking about not wanting me 5 years ago.
Well, let me ask you this. I want to go back for a second.
Yeah.
You got eggs thrown at you. You were bullied. You feel horrible. You're cleaning up the mess. You don't want your parents to come and find this to see how weak you are.
Yes, or how, you know,
embarrassed you are. Sure. So how, if you can, how do you go from a 17-year-old kid who's smart, sort of a loner, has a couple of friends, is bullied? How do you get, I mean, moving to the States changed your life, right? If you were there, if you stayed, you're not here right now, right?
No, not at all. I would probably be a doctor or something like that. I would probably be a doctor. Yeah, coming to the States.
When did you find out? Do you remember the day your dad said, hey?
That what?
Well, why'd you move to the States?
Oh, I moved alone for college. I didn't move.
Oh, you just moved?
I just moved.
I thought maybe your family moved.
My family came here much later.
Much later.
Yeah, like 10 years later.
So you decided to move to the States when you were going to go to college. Where'd you go to college?
It's a small school called Grinnell College in Grinnell, Iowa.
What made you go there?
First of all, I didn't know how big America was and how many different kinds of cities there are. You watch movies, it's all New York or LA, and you're like, oh, America's like a big city.
Yeah, but you pick Grinnell.
Well, I show up and I was like, this is not the America that I was advertised.
Right. Not that it's bad.
Not that it's bad, but it's very different. I thought truly all of America was the same. It's absurd how big this country is. It's absurd that all of this is one country. No wonder we have problems.
How many people are in Pakistan?
It's like, it's 20 million there. It's like, I think it's like 50 million. What is it? What's the number?
193.2 million.
Yeah, okay. We have 350 million.
306
million. So we're huge.
We're bigger.
Yeah, but you're also much bigger geographically.
Yes, true.
And politically, yeah. Obviously. Yeah, I moved to America and I went to college and it was just the first time. I don't think I was a person until then. Like I wasn't a person until I was 20. And that's when I realized that I was funny and that people were interested in things I had to say. I never had that feeling.
When did you find out you were funny, or when did you discover? Where in college, what happened that made you go, wait a minute, something's different here?
I was just like making fun of something, and I remember my friends were laughing so hard they couldn't, like, they were just like couldn't talk. Their tears down their face.
Were they stoned?
No, and I remember being like, hey, this is pretty great. It's like a superpower. And that's when I realized, I was like, oh, I am funny. And people would be like, you know, Kamal's, he's the funny one. And I was like, I didn't know that. And it was really, really exciting to finally, if you had told me before the age of 19, describe yourself, I wouldn't be able to describe myself in any way other than, I don't even know if I would say shy, because I didn't even know what I was.
You just were.
I just was a blob, you know. I never felt like a person until I'd been in America a couple of years. And honestly, the people I was surrounded by were like so nice and kind and interested. I just had not had the feeling of someone being interested in anything I had to say until I was probably 20 years old.
That is beautiful and sad.
It is.
And I understand that.
Yeah.
Because I went through it.
I'm sure. You grew up in New York.
I was born in New York. I grew up in Indiana. But I understand the sense that I wasn't like, I mean, no one threw eggs. Well, I mean, not eggs. But, you know, I just remember going, what do I have to offer? What? I'm lost in the crowd here. I don't fit in anywhere. And it wasn't until I went to college, till I was about 20, that I started to realize also that, wow, my friends, like, they're like, you're funny. Listen to him do this impression. Listen to this guy. He's funny. So I had to find, kind of channel that. What am I doing with this kind of...
And then you had success pretty early on. How old were you?
No, I graduated college in 95. I went to New York, and I got, like, this independent movie in, like, 97. And then I started to get some success in 98. So I was, like, 26.
That's 3 years, though. That's pretty quick.
Pretty, yeah.
No, after college? Yeah, 3 years after college. But I stayed an extra year in college because I wasn't that bright. But what I'm saying is, up till college, like you, I didn't know
what. Yeah, I'm 26.
I was done.
I mean, 26 is early, of course, but it's not that early. I mean, some people have their lives changed at, like,
Justin Bieber.
20. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a special case. But I see, you know, you sort of around people and you see someone who's like 20 or 21 and suddenly become a huge star, and that's gonna be weird.
So what do you say to people who are like lost? There's a lot of people in high school that are just meandering through life, just saying, going, what's gonna happen to me? I always try to say, hey, hang on. You're like, do I go to college? I'm like, yes, not because of you to figure, it's to figure, to grow up a little more,
figure out who you are, you know. And it's very, it's, I know, I'm sure there are people who are struggling through high school, and when I had that, it doesn't feel like it's ever going to be over. Like, I wasn't looking forward to graduation as like, thank God
I'm out of here.
I wasn't thinking of it like that. Oh. I was like, this feeling that, because you understand that you're not going to be around these people your whole life, but I don't think I understood that this feeling would go away at some point. I thought that life was feeling like this. I did not connect the way I felt directly with the way these people were making me feel. I felt like I deserve to feel like this. And if it's not these people making me feel like this, doesn't mean I won't be feeling like this. Like, this is what it's going to be. It's going to be, you're going to be alone. You're not going to know who you are. Nobody's going to give a shit about you. And that every moment is going to be pretty useless and painful. And I wouldn't say I was depressed. I never felt like that. I feel lucky that's not something that I've had to deal with. But that feeling of being unwanted and useless and not being good at anything and not knowing what you want to do, I never felt like that would go away, you know?
And the great thing is, it will.
It will go away.
Yes.
It will go away. Like, listen, if you have bullies in high school, I don't know how to fight back through that. I have no advice for you there.
Fight back by succeeding.
By just figuring out who you are.
Yes.
And figuring out what you want to do. You may not be able to defeat them in high school. I certainly wasn't. Figure out what you like and what you want to do and try and stick with it. It's hard. I mean, you know, I started doing comedy in 2001, end of 2001, and I didn't get my first job that paid me money in comedy until 2008. So it was 7 years. Which,
but so college, you started doing stand-up around that time?
My senior year was the first time I did.
Do you remember the first time you went up? Were they encouraging you? Like, you got to go do it. You got
to
go do it.
Oh, my God. The first time I went up is to this day maybe the best set I've ever had.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I was. I just sort of got obsessed with stand-up. You know, so I realized I was funny. My friends were like, you're funny. I got upset. I'd never really seen stand-up, and I got obsessed with stand-up. I watched so much stand-up.
Who are you watching? Who are your idols?
So I loved Jerry Seinfeld. Loved him. I really, really loved Zach Galifianakis.
Oh, Jesus.
Really loved this guy, Mitch Hedberg, who has since passed
Mitch
away.
Mitch Hedberg has one of the best lines. He goes, rice is a great snack if you're ever in the mood for 2000 of something.
Yeah, he's the best,
he was
man.
Funny, yeah.
Loved him. Loved Stephen Wright. There's a guy named Jake Johansson who's really, really, really funny, who was a big reason why I started. And Conan. I mean, dude, I watched that late night, the Conan show, and him and Andy, and being obsessed with it. And so those are the people. And Beavis and Butthead.
Good.
I love Beavis and Butthead.
I do too.
I just was like, I'd never seen comedy like that. And same with Conan, watching like the weird. I realized.
I used to do sketch comedy in Conan when I first went to New York within like a year.
Really?
I did like this character called the Amsterdam Kids. They were misinformed about Amsterdam's liberal social policies. And I did like six. We were characters that didn't make the show. But then they liked us enough and they kept bringing us back. And so we'd make like $600 and go. I was like, oh my God, I'm making like money to be on late night, this Conan show before
how,
I was.
And how great is that? Who were you? Who were the other people in the sketch?
Nobody really. But my manager represented a bunch of nobodies, like I think maybe it was Chappelle.
Oh, nobody's David Chappelle.
I'm kidding. I think Louis C.K. and Mitch Hedberg, and those were his clients, and me. I was like an actor, and he was like, I want to represent you.
How great.
But I remember going to see those stand-up comedians in New York back when.
Those guys, Chappelle and Louis and all those guys. Yeah, so I got really, really obsessed with stand-up, and I watched so much of it, like good stuff.
What was your first set? How long?
That's another crazy thing. I did like fucking 25 minutes the first time I got on stage.
Were you just improvising?
No. I wrote it all down. I still write down all my stand-up.
So it's never improvised. You always have a set. Like you don't...
I'll go off the script now all the time. But I always go on with something that I have written down word for word and then try and forget it on stage. I write a lot on stage, but I don't go up on stage like, oh, I'll just talk about this. I won't choose to do that. Sometimes I'll go on and think of something and just go off. But I always write out my whole joke. So what happened was junior year, I sort of have this, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. I'm freaking out. You know, it's a year left.
Your parents are asking you what was going on there.
Yeah. And I sort of studied, you know, I studied philosophy and I studied computer science. And the assumption was I would go into computer science programming, and I was no good at it, and it gave me nothing, and I kind of was really going through an existential crisis in college, being like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And then there was an open mic. This friend of mine who was a year older than me started doing these comedy open mics at this coffee shop on campus, and I went and watched it, and it was just like, he was really funny, and everybody was really funny. It was like four or five people. You just sign up and do it. And the crowd was packed. And I was like, my friends were like, you should try it. And I was like, I have to try it. It was that thing where it just hurt to not try it.
How scared were you?
Terrified. But my fear was only slightly less than my need to try it. I just could not try it. I had no choice.
I like what you just said.
What?
Your fear was only slightly less than your need to do it.
I had no option. I truly had no option.
And you remember going up?
I remember. So I wrote down all these jokes. You know, I wrote a bunch of jokes. I was sort of, again, I was obsessed with it. So I was just like all the time just writing.
What was your first joke? First thing you said.
I remember one of my first jokes was I wanted to be a scientist. And I wanted to have a unit of measurement named after myself because all the cool scientists have them, you know, like Joules, Newton, Mr. Kilometer. But I wanted something cool, you know, like I wanted like turn the torpedoes up to 5 Nanjianis, like 5 Nanjianis. That's way too much. Most people can't handle 1 Nanjiani. That was like my first joke.
That's funny.
I did like 25 minutes. I worked on it. And
how did you feel?
I felt like a fucking god.
Did you feel right?
I felt like I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it. I was terrified. I went on stage and I did my whole thing and I fucking crushed. It's all my friends. It's very supportive. This is like the best environment. The coffee shop is packed. I sort of became, I was still like pretty shy, so I wasn't like a celebrity on campus, but people every now and then would be like, hey, you did that thing. Like, I remember this guy who was he was a baseball player. He's a very nice guy, but he was like this jacked, huge baseball player. And I was like, I'd done it once, and I was sitting and doing homework, and he was like, hey, you did that. He's like, you're so funny. I was like, thank you. He's like, how many times have you done it? And I was like, once. He was like, that was your first time? And I was like, yeah. He's like, holy shit, man. You gotta keep doing it. And I remember getting off stage and feeling really cocky and feeling like, oh, I found something I know I can be good at. I knew immediately at that point, I was like, I know there's a lot of work to do. I don't know if I'll ever be successful. I don't know where this goes, but I found something that I know I can be good at. That is exciting to me.
Do you remember the first time you bombed?
I do remember the first
time. Was it the next time?
Nope. So I did it that, you know, so this thing would happen once a semester, right? So I did that. I did my first semester senior year, did this 25-minute set, killed top to bottom. It was, and I'm not being cocky, it was a very supportive environment, but it really, really, you know, it could not have gone better. I remember there was this, like, really cute girl who worked at the coffee shop who was, like, way out of my league, and I saw her laughing, and I was like, okay, this is new. This feeling is great. So then the next semester, right before I graduate, I do it again. I write another 20 minutes, completely different. It goes really well again. Not as good as the first time, but
good.
But really, really good, you know? So in 1 year, I'd done it twice. And at that point, I was like, I got to move to a place where I got to try this. I don't know if I'm going to be successful with this, but I got to keep going. So I moved to Chicago because I knew, you know, the people that I really looked up to, like Bill Murray and
Will Ferrell.
Yeah, you know, now it's like Carell and Colbert and Tina Fey and everybody's from Chicago. So I moved there, and I remember I opened the Chicago Reader, which is like sort of the local hip, newspaper, and looked at open mics and just sort of went out and just signed up for open mics and started doing open mics. And that was like a really good – I mean, when I started, dude, these are the people who started comedy around me in Chicago. It was do you know, like, Hannibal Buress? Do you know him? Mm-hmm. Him and I started around the same time. T.J. Miller – started around the same time. Pete Holmes started around the same time. This guy, Kyle Kinane, who's like super fucking funny. He's like one of the funniest guys in the world. He started around the same time. So we had this like crazy crew of people, and we would perform to empty crowds. And there was a comedy club in town. And so I'd been doing it for like 2, 3, 4 months, and I hadn't had a bad set yet. And I'd sort of gotten in with these comedians, and things were going really well. I was sort of like the new funny guy, you know. And I was writing all the time, and I was doing really well. And then I got to do a guest set at the comedy club. It's called Zanies. So that was
Zanies.
Like, you know Zanies?
I know Zanies, yeah.
It's a great club. Did you ever go to Zanies, Rob?
Yeah.
Do you know where it is?
I used to shoot a lot of comedy.
Yeah.
Like Up, and yeah, I've shot Hannibal and Kyle there.
Where?
At Up Comedy Club at Second City.
Oh, Up. Yeah, that started after I left.
Yeah.
I've done it since then. It's a great space.
So Zanies, you go there and you think you've got confidence. You've been killing it.
Yeah, and I was...
Was it packed?
It was packed. I got a 10-minute guest set in front of someone. I don't remember who it is, but there's a headliner, and I got a 10-minute guest set that's like an audition spot. And I'm not cocky at this point.
Are you nervous?
Each time going up for me is very nerve-wracking still.
Still?
It's still nerve-wracking, but I'm doing well on stage, but it's... I don't mean today it's not nerve-wracking, but at that point, it was nerve-wracking. And it was nerve-wracking for years and years. I didn't stop being nervous to go on stage until just a few years ago. So I'd be nervous every time. So I'm nervous, I go on stage, and I do my... At this point, I just have like 10 minutes. That's everything I have. So all the college stuff, I've tried it. Very little of it works outside. I have 10 minutes that work. So I've got like, I know where I'm starting. 2 minutes is killer. Then I got other stuff. Then I know the last 2 minutes is killer. You know, like that's how it's structured. And the middle stuff is good. It works, but I know where
kill
to start.
Kill them in the beginning, kill them in the end.
Yeah. So I go on and I do my killer stuff in the beginning, and it's just not working. I'm not like bombing at this point, but I am not doing as well as I'm used to doing.
And is your heart beating?
My heart's beating. I start sweating. My ears get hot. I could see all their faces looking at me. And I see that feel. I don't know if I'm putting this on them or if in my head.
They're nervous.
In my head, I could see that they're thinking, why is this guy on stage? I could see in my head that they're thinking, why does this guy deserve to be on stage? He's not good at this. He doesn't deserve to be on that stage. What is he doing on that stage?
Oh, boy.
And I could see that on their faces.
How debilitating is that?
So I do the first 2 minutes, and every moment is a gut punch. I do the first 2 minutes, and I don't have them. And so immediately I go, all right, I got to go to my strongest. So then I go to my last 2 minutes, and I do that, and I don't have them. And at this point, I've done all the best shit I have.
And now you have your middle shit.
I have my middle shit for 6 minutes. And I know I got to do it. I know I got to be on stage because if you go short.
No laughs, very few laughs.
Very few laughs. I bet if I look back on it now.
It was better than you thought.
I bet it was better than I thought, but I remember, and I'm just on stage and I've got 6 minutes left and I'm just going through my material and I could just see their faces. They're eating, they're drinking, they're just looking at me like, they're looking at me like, why did he think he could do this? Why does he think he can do this?
And that either gets you incredibly motivated or it makes you just say, fuck, I'll never do this again.
Oh my God, dude. Well, this is what happens. So I finish it. I get off stage. I leave the place. It might have been, honestly, it might have been opening for like Richard Lewis or someone. I don't know. He wasn't there. He didn't watch. Richard Lewis would always wait in the car outside until the MC introduced him.
Did you like Richard Lewis?
I don't really know his stuff that well, so I can't really.
Yeah, who's to say? Everybody likes people for, you know, for different reasons.
Yeah,
let's just say that.
I don't really. Not too familiar with his work. I knew who he was.
Right,
famous.
So you walk off.
I walk off. I go home, and I'm like, I have to get on stage immediately to get rid of that. Like I was like, I cannot wait to get back on stage and have that not be the last.
And when did you go back on stage?
Probably, if it wasn't the next day, it was the day after that. It was pretty soon. It was not that day. That day I went home and I like...
Cried.
I, dude.
Numb. You're numb.
I wasn't numb. I was feeling it. I didn't cry, but I was devastated. I was awful. But the good thing was, by that point, I'd probably been on stage 35 to 40 times. So I knew, just intellectually, I wasn't like, I'm a fraud. I was like, okay, so that's 40 good ones and one bad one. Gotta get rid of the bad one. So then I got up back on stage, did well, and then obviously since then I've bombed many times, but after that first one and then doing well the next time, I understood like, oh, this is part of it. There are gonna be sets you do that aren't gonna be good, and that doesn't mean you're not a good stand-up, but your job is to make sure that minimize those, and you can still bomb, but the floor goes up, the worst set you can have goes up, and hopefully you have them less often. And I remember there was this message board in Chicago, this was early 2000s, that like all the comedians would go to and post like just shit about Chicago, like I got a new show coming up, watch this, or there's a good open mic here, or mostly just people fucking fighting with each other. But I wrote this long post about how it felt to like bomb, and I remember a lot of comedians sort of were supportive, and that was really, really helpful.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a very supportive crew, like because we didn't really play to big audiences generally, and we didn't really do that comedy club that much. We were sort of trying to make each other laugh, and it was a real emphasis on being original and having a point of view. That's what was important. Like if you were hack, you would get it was pretty merciless. So I think that's kind of why so many great comedians came from that little point in time, because I think we really, you know, pushed each other to try and find our voice. We didn't do it for a long time, but we knew from the beginning that that's what.
And then you moved to New York.
And then I moved to, and then basically, so I was doing stand up in Chicago, and you know, you sort of get to do the best shows pretty quickly. And I was spinning my wheels. Like the plan was be in Chicago for 2 years, then go to New York.
Get a set. Get an hour long set. Is that what you were aiming at?
Yeah, but I wasn't even thinking of it like that, because even in New York, if you're doing really well, you don't get an hour long set for a while. I didn't really have a plan beyond just move to New York and do stand up. So the plan was 2 years. I stayed for 6 years in Chicago, and those were probably, when I look back on like my career, that was probably the most static time. That was probably the worst time for me. Was the last 3 years in Chicago where I was doing the same shows, just going out with my buddies. It was fun, but I just was kind of stuck and spinning my wheels. And I didn't realize until much later that I was just scared of trying to take it to the next level, you know? But you know what broke me out of my malaise was the stuff that happens in the Big Sick. I met this girl I fell in love with her without knowing it. She got really, really, really sick.
And that was where?
That was in Chicago.
That was in Chicago, right.
Yeah.
I forgot it was, I didn't remember city, I just didn't remember where.
Dude, and you don't think of it like, you know, when something like that happens, you don't think of it like, oh, life is fleeting, and we all are mortal, and we have to live our lives and figure out what we want to do, and you got to do it right now and seize the moment. You don't think of it like that. But within her, after her waking up, within 3 months, we had changed completely everything about our lives. Within 3 months of that, we had gotten married secretly. I had quit my job. She had quit her job. And we had both moved to New York for me to, like, try and make it in comedy.
Okay,
within 3 months.
I mean, this is, and it's such an effed up story. So is it true that she heckles you one night and you sleep with her the same night?
No.
That didn't happen. Didn't that happen in the movie?
Yes, that happens in the movie, but in real life, she heckled me, and I was like, oh my God, that girl's really cute. And I looked for her at the show afterwards, and she was gone. She was so embarrassed, she left. Then a couple of days later, I run into her at another place.
And then you had sex.
At a bar. No.
Okay.
I was like, you heckled me, and it's the same conversation that's in the movie, pretty much. And I write my, you know, I write her name in Urdu, which was my move at the time.
Okay, so you got her number. You started talking.
We start talking.
How many dates?
What do you mean?
How many times did you go out before she got sick?
Oh, we were together for a few months.
For a few months?
Yeah.
You were in love?
Yeah, but I didn't know it, and we didn't say that to each other.
Right, and then you find out she gets sick, right?
So she gets sick.
Most people would run. Most people would be like, I don't know what that was.
Again, it did not feel like I had a choice.
So you dated a couple of months?
Probably about 8 months we'd been dating. So we've been dating for a while. And she just was sick. And but I didn't even think she was that sick. It was just like a flu that wouldn't go away, you know. And she's also likes to hide it. So she didn't let on how sick she was. And then I remember there was a day where she was just going to the doctor in the afternoon. And I was at work. And I just kept calling her to be like, how did the doctor's appointment go? How did the appointment go? And I couldn't get in touch with her. And I did this show. And I remember freaking out what's going on. And then she finally texted me. And she was like, I'm in the emergency room. And I went there that night. And she said that she'd gone to the doctor. And the doctor called an ambulance and sent her to the hospital. She was that sick. And I hung out with her that night. And she was like awake. And the next morning, the doctor came and put her in a coma. And I remember I watched them put her in the coma. It's like not good. If I hope you're never in a position where someone you know is being put in a medically induced coma. But if you are in a position where that's going to happen, do not be there for it. Do not watch it because they won't remember it because the medication that they use to put you in a medically induced coma gives you amnesia. You know, it is just, you don't want to watch it because it's very violent. The body really fights it. They really fight it. She really fought it.
Was it terrifying?
Yeah, they like tied her down. And they, you know, it's, just don't do it. Yeah. Don't be there for that.
You can still remember exactly what it was like.
And they don't give a shit because they do so many of these. So they weren't like, hey, turn away. I just watched them do it. Anyway, and I remember.
Had you said you loved her at this point?
No. But I remember seeing her laying there when the thing was over and she was in her coma and the doctors had left. I remember specifically seeing her in that coma, laying there and being like, if she comes out of this, we're going to get married. I remember that was one of the first thoughts I had. I know it sounds a little creepy. No.
It almost made me cry.
Yeah,
actually.
But it really, I remember seeing her like that and being like, if she comes out of this, we're going to get married.
Why?
I don't know. I think, you know, I was probably, because my parents wanted me to marry someone else. There was all this fear and there was just a lot of things I was afraid of in my life that I was afraid to confront just because they were too big. And so my feelings for her weren't clear to myself. But in that moment, they became very clear to me. In that moment, as I saw her laying there like that, I was like, oh, I love this girl. And if she comes out of this, we're going to spend the rest of our lives together. I had that, like, very clear. It just became very clear.
Was it just overwhelming?
Yeah. You know, and then that whole time, so people who haven't seen the movie, she in real life, she was in a coma for 8 days. And the whole time, they have no idea what's going on. And she's getting worse and worse and worse. And people sort of think of it as being brave that I was there the whole time, or brave that, I don't know, just to be there. I never felt brave. I just felt very scared. It was fear. And you just do it because that's all there is to do. You sort of do it because you what else are you going to do? You know,
you're either going to be there or not, and you wanted to be there.
I didn't even want to be there. I had to be there. I needed to be there. I just didn't. There was no other option. There was no decision. There was no choice. It was, this is where I am until.
When she woke up.
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment?
So basically, you know, I would sort of hang out with her parents, and they flew in from North Carolina.
And they didn't like you at first?
No, we changed a little bit in the movie, but it was just very awkward.
Awkward, of course, yeah.
But it was also that feeling of, we're the only people in the world that really know what we're going through. Nobody else understands. I remember I would go to, like, Walgreens and get really angry at people buying gum, being like, how do you get to have a normal life? Why? Oh, fuck
Jesus.
You. That feeling of, why is the world going on? Why are these people laughing? Basically, we were... go there, and I had a day job, an office job, and I just stopped going. I would go, I had her car, I kept her car, they were staying at her apartment. I would go pick them up at like 9 in the morning, we'd be there, and we'd sort of hang out all day, because she had like 8 different specialists, and you know, someone comes at 9:30, and someone comes at 10:30, so you know when their rounds are, and you're sort of there until 6 or 7 p.m., when you're not allowed to visit anymore. So you sort of, it was like your job, you just go hang out in the waiting room, you meet with all the doctors each day, and they tell you what they're working on. And at the end, you go home, and you return the next day. And I remember in the elevator up to her floor was always when I had the hope, because I was like, all the other time, you know she's not getting better, because you know if she got better, you'd get a fucking text. They would call her parents would call me. And I had my phone on me the whole time, and I had her phone on me the whole time. But on the elevator, when you wouldn't get a signal, you'd be like, oh, I could get out of the elevator, and I could have that text. I could have that missed call, you know. So the elevator is when you really felt the hope, you know. And I remember in the beginning, you're like, the hospital, you're lost, don't know where to go. And then by the end, you're like, you got to walk from here to there. This is the best elevator. You take this up. You know the most efficient way to get to a room. And I remember... it was the three of us. We got off the elevator, and one of her, it was her doctor and the doctor's like assistant, who's also a doctor. We got off, and the doctor was very stern, but she was like, congratulations. We're like, what? And they're like, she's up. And I remember us like gunning down the hall. And oh my God, I'm getting all emotional. You walk and you look in there, and it was pretty similar to how it's in the movie, except I was with her parents. And you look in, and she was sitting up and awake. There's a machine that she's hooked up to with all these numbers, and the nurse had taught me, like, okay, these are the two numbers you're looking for. This number is bad because it's this, it should be this, and this number is bad because it's this, it should be this. And I remember seeing her and first looking, and the numbers being under the numbers, you know, the numbers are good for the first time. And she's up and just being like, oh, my. It's just like subtly everything just sort of lifts and goes away. And the nurse is like, you know, she's out of it. Like, it's going to take her a long time to recover. She's going to need physical therapy, because if you don't move your muscles for 8 days, everything stops working. They're like, she's going to be on a respirator still for a long time. And
were the three of you, the parents, too, all just emotional? So was everybody emotional?
Yeah, it was just emotional, and it wasn't even complicated emotions. It was just pure joy. It was just like happiness.
And was she just...
She's miserable.
She's miserable.
She's miserable because she has no idea. She remembers...
What's happening?
She remembers going to the doctor, and suddenly she like can't talk. She can't move anything. She's got this thing down her throat that's very painful. And so that's the other weird thing, is that for her... for us, when we're at our most, you know, feeling despair, she's out. She doesn't remember. And then when we're feeling joy, she feels despair and pain. And so so the next 2 weeks for her, I mean, the next few months for her are very, very tough. It takes her a while to get back to.
When did she tell her? I mean,
that she'd been under for 8 days.
Well, I'm sure you told her right away, right?
No, because they said, you know, for a few days, she's not going to remember these next few days because they have to wean her off the medication that puts her in the coma. So you could tell her, but you'd have to tell her again. And I remember the other weird thing is as we, because we were then packing up and moving, and I used to get Entertainment Weeklies, you know, we both used to read Entertainment Weeklies. And she was like, when we were moving and packing to go to New York, she was like, wait, I haven't seen this one. And I was like, oh, that's the fucking week that you were under. That's why you don't remember that. Yeah, and then you know, we sort of knew she was okay, and it just took her up. It just takes a while. She had to learn to walk again and all that stuff.
Did you tell her when you were in that coma, when I watched you, I had this feeling I knew what I wanted to marry you?
I told her later, yeah.
How long did that take before you told her?
Probably not too long. I mean, I think we actually talked about, you know, we didn't have a traditional proposal.
Well,
what'd
she say? I mean, did she say right away, like, you're crazy?
No, she felt the same way about me as I felt about her.
Were you scared that she might not?
No. I knew she did.
Really?
Yeah. We sort of talked about it, and we went and, you know, once she was healthy enough, we went and stood in line at the courthouse and just went and got married and then went to brunch afterwards.
How close are your parents with her now?
Very close. We're all pretty close now.
Everybody's tight. Her family, your family, everybody's tight.
Yeah. Yeah.
How nice is that?
It's great. It's great. I mean, that's the thing that I had was, even though my mom didn't approve of her, she knew. She saw how I was when she was sick, so she knew that this was real, you know? So she just, at that point.
If he's here for this, he's going to be here for anything.
Yeah, she just knew that this was going to happen, and she just had to do the best she could to get on board.
Have you thought of writing a sequel, The Big Sick 2, where you get sick? see if she sticks around.
Yeah, it's Big Sick 2 is just this. It's this podcast, and then there's a guy. He's cutting, you know, he's mowing the lawn outside, and he's running the agua.
Yeah, we had a gardener. We had to cut some stuff out. If you heard some stuff, the gardener was pretty loud, but he was just doing his job, right?
Yeah, he's doing his job.
Yeah, I remember you were telling the story, and you looked at me like, what is happening
here? I thought it was in the headphones.
We had sound effects for your story.
Yeah, it was sound effects. We put gardening sound effects over your story.
Yeah, really, really put you, even though there was no garden in the story.
So you're the fourth season of Silicon Valley?
Five. We've done five.
You've done five. How many are you going to do? Do you enjoy it still?
I do. I mean, I love the show. It changed my life. And I love everyone I work with. I don't know how many more they're going to do. It's sort of up to them, you know?
But you'll do whatever? You'd like to be a part of it as long as it lasts?
Yeah.
Martin Starr, I worked with Martin.
What'd you guys do?
We did a short film years ago called Eyeball Eddie.
Oh, I know of it.
You do?
I haven't seen it, but I know what it is. He's a wrestler, right?
Yeah, we did a little short film, and I really loved working with
him. Do you? Are you still in touch with him?
Yeah, he played football with us a couple years ago. He came out and played football on a weekend. I organized like co-ed football and softball.
Oh,
and
really?
Stuff like that.
Yeah, I was texting with him this morning.
You got to give him my love. He's such a sweetie.
I will. I will tell him right after this.
This has been great. I mean, so you're doing. Look, Dave Bautista and I were friends. He texts me and he says, "Kumail wants to be on the show." I'm like, "Really? He'll do it?" Yeah. And I was so excited. I was like, "Oh, that's great." He's fantastic.
I texted with Dave today about something else, and he was like, "I heard you're doing Rosie's podcast. Is that what he calls you?"
Yeah. I just saw him in. In Houston. And he actually tweeted. I had people, you know, send tweets, questions.
Wait, what are you all doing in Houston?
Are you following me? I think you should be following me.
I do follow you.
Do you follow me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Because Dave Bautista says, ask Kumail how he got the glutes so tight for Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates, Dat Ass, and why he loves sad songs. That's what Dave Bautista at Dave
Wow,
Bautista.
Those are two very personal questions. I did a lot of squats for my nude scene in Mike and...
Did you?
Yeah. I did a lot of squats. You know, I didn't quite get to where I wanted to get to.
But would you show Emily your ass intermittently, like throughout the weeks, and say, hey, does it look better?
No, I knew how it looked. I didn't get what I needed.
I would have every day. How does my ass look? Just like it did a minute ago.
Well, she loves me, so she doesn't tell me the truth. But I really tried to get in shape for that, and I didn't quite get what I wanted to get to because I'm like super naked for like solid 5 minutes of that movie.
Dong?
No dong. Although the director did say that he had to CGI my
CGID
my CGI my balls and my taint out.
CGIBT.
Yeah,
CGI balls and taint. Yeah. Right. All right. So and you and I both love sad songs.
I love.
Do you love 70s sad songs?
Which ones?
Like I'm not talking about moving in, and I don't want to change your life.
No, I don't know that
or
one.
Or how about? I like 70s ballads and Foreigner.
Yeah, I love that stuff too.
What's your favorite Foreigner song?
What is the big one? What are their big
ones? Well, they say, I want to know what love is.
Yeah, I love that one.
I've been waiting.
Yeah, I love that one. You know what?
What do you like?
I like a lot of like my favorite is Bruce Springsteen. He's got a lot of great sad songs.
Hey, little girl. I like that one.
Yeah, that one's great. That's a sexy song.
Thank you.
Hey, little girl, is your daddy home? Did he go and leave you all alone? Ooh, that is creepy.
I want to take it high.
Yeah. That video is good, too.
But what sad songs?
I like, you know, I love The River, Bruce Springsteen. That's a very sad song. I love a lot of, like, really sad folk singers. There's a guy named Bill Morrissey who's passed away. Yeah. He has two great breakup albums. I love Dylan, Bob Dylan, of course, you know. He has an album called Standing Eight that is one of the saddest breakup albums. Love that. Then he has another one. Listen to this. So he has Standing Eight is his album that's, like, the angry breakup, you know, where it's, like, fuck you. And the songs are like that. They're, like, sad but with anger, and then he got remarried and broke up with that one, and that breakup is more like about like we're still friends, just the love went away. It's like a little more wistful. It's like sort of love fading away, right, rather than exploding.
I like Tom Waits too. I bet you like Tom Waits, right?
But that album is called Something I Saw or Thought I Saw, which is a great title for a breakup album.
Something I Saw or Thought I Saw. Ken Marino says, favorite things Tom about Ken great. Marino.
Favorite thing about Ken Marino?
Be detailed.
I love how not narcissistic he is. You know, I like that he's not focused on himself and that he really, really. I do love Ken, man. I did this series called Burning Love with Ken that he was the star of and he directed, and we had the best time. And it was really early on. It was before Silicon Valley. We'd done this monster movie together called Bad Milo, and that's where we met. And I've been a fan of his for a long time. And we had the best time. I love Ken.
Robert Lee Gardner at Bob is Going Ham. Will you ask Kamala if he's ever going to bring the X-Files podcast back? I really miss that show.
I think there may be a special here and there, but it's tough to go back. It's tough for me to go back and do that show again. I love that show. And there was a little time where I was just taking stuff I loved and making like work out of it. And now I enjoy just having it be something fun.
I like it. Pop culture mama.
Pop culture mama.
Get it, Reed. I'd love to know if working in Silicon Valley has changed how Kamal thinks about technology in his life.
Yes. I always thought of technology as just being a positive, and now I understand how technology can really, really ruin our lives as well. That it's not a force for good or a force for bad. It's a force, and it can be used for good or bad. And in some ways, it's many, many, many times bigger and more powerful than us, and it's scary.
Did you say that line on the show?
I should say it on the show.
It sounds like it was written for you.
It's very, very scary. And the scary thing is that the people who are the heads of these tech companies have free reign. They seem to have no focus on the ethical or moral implications of what they're doing or that what they make can be used for bad. I think this is something that people are talking about now, but for years and years, these people have just been stomping around doing nothing. There aren't laws about the internet or anything, because the people who make laws are completely out of touch with how fast technology is moving. I mean, we've seen, you know, the negative, like all the fake news shit on Facebook and how that affected us and changed our world. And it's very scary. Nothing's being done about it.
I mean, you got a lot of stuff. You're always working. What's this Men in Black spinoff film?
Yeah, just finished shooting that. I just got back Friday from London. It's Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson.
Chris Hemsworth, how sexy is he?
Too much.
Too much.
He walks into a room and changes the gravity of it. I fucking hate it. He's so handsome and so funny and so nice.
That's such a good dad, right? Good family guy.
Oh, God. So buff. Oh, God. Can't handle
it. I'm not gay, but I'd give that dude a handy.
Oh, yeah. You know, you're not gay, but if you see a unicorn, you got to ride it, you know?
Fucking ride it hard, yeah. Dude. Absolutely. That's a unicorn. That doesn't count.
But him and Tessa Thompson are both fantastic.
And what's the Bautista movie you did?
Oh, dude. I did this movie with Bautista. We had the best time. I hope the movie's going to be good. I haven't seen it yet.
Well, let me tell you.
Wait.
What he said to me, and he honestly, this was unsolicited. He said, Kumail is an awesome, serious actor. Like, his moments when he... I'm, like, taken aback. Like, I'm like, oh, my God, how good you are.
Well...
That's what he said.
Well, Bautista's so good. I don't want to tell you.
He is such a good dude. I mean, listen, in Hollywood, you always hear about everybody's great, and this guy's great. But Dave Bautista, he was on the show, and his podcast is coming out. He is one of my favorite... Wasn't he your favorite, Rob?
Not my favorite, but he's
I mean, one of your favorite. He's
well,
the nicest.
You're my favorite.
Yeah, there we go.
One of the nicest guys.
I will tell you, Bautista is probably the most good person.
He's like, a good person. Genuine.
I'm very lucky that I have a number of good people in my life, and I feel very, very lucky that Bautista's a new, good, genuinely good person I have in my life who is also... He's a fucking great actor, and he's so funny, and I learned so much working with him, and we had the best time doing this movie. It's a movie called Stuber. It comes out next May. It got a really big release date.
Oh, good.
Fox. Yeah, it's like Memorial Day or whatever.
So they must like it.
I hope it's good, man. We had the best time. It's a big, funny
action comedy.
All you can
do is enjoy it. And see what happens.
We shot in Atlanta, fell in love with Atlanta, fell in love with Dave Bautista. I mean, I could not ask for a better professional and personal experience.
What's your Twitter handle?
Kumail N, KUMAILN.
And what's your Instagram handle? Same thing.
Same thing.
Kumail, thank you for allowing me to be inside of you today.
Oh, thanks for being inside of me.
This was so easy and fun.
Yeah, I had a blast.
Thanks
man.
For opening up, almost getting emotional. No, I like that. I like it was just a conversation. I just wanted to know more about you.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I had a great time. And please invite me to your horror movie nights. Emily and I are massive horror fans.
Me too. I love
horror
movies.
I see Martyrs sitting over there.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't that disturbing?
That movie is a hard-ass movie.
Did you see Dead Girl?
Yes.
That was fucked up. Yeah. That's kind of fucked up. What's your top three right now horror movies of all time?
It changes, you know? It's hard to get away from, like, you know...
How about Scariest? The ones that really... I'll tell you something. Blair Witch, the first time I saw it, the hype, scared the shit out of me. Paranormal Activity, the first time, scared the shit out of
me.
The Shining, The Exorcist, The Omen, those movies.
I would put Silence of the Lambs up there.
Silence of the Lambs.
All those movies are definitely movies that scared the shit out of me. I mean, you know, in Paranormal Activity, when the person's just standing there and time's going and they're just like... Not moving, so fucking good. All those movies are really, really good.
I think
good.
We should write a horror movie together.
I would love to do a horror movie. I feel a little scared to do a horror movie because I don't know how to do it.
You could do it better than most of the people.
It feels magical to me. Like, you know, most movies I watch and I learn and I'm like, all right, because The Big Sick was our version of like rom-coms, but also those James L. Brooks movies like Broadcast News or Terms of Endearment. Like, that's what we wanted to make our version of that. And with horror, Emily and I have talked and we want to do horror, but to both of us, it just feels like magic. Like, I don't know how they do.
Well, I think that what happens is they just throw out horror movies all the time, and we get sucked into seeing them because they have a good teaser, they're just not very good. I see them over and over, and they break my heart. And I just think you don't need big stars. You don't need big stars. You don't need a lot of money. You need a good story, and you need the right story or in the right scares. You don't need to always have a sound effect to scare people.
No, and I think the great thing about horror movies is that it's gotta be primal, right? That fear is gotta be primal.
Real, guttural, freaking. Oh my God, I'm in that guy. The Strangers. You're like, oh my God, this could happen.
The Strangers.
This could happen.
Have you seen a movie called Them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Them's real good.
Them's real good, man.
Them's real good. And I think horror and comedy are both similar in that they're both based on surprise, right? Like, you're not going to laugh at something if you see it coming. You're not going to get scared at something if you see it coming. So both of those, I think, are very similar. And I think both of those are also why... I think they're also most misunderstood by critics. There are comedy and horror the most that, like, will get bad reviews, and then years later they're classics, because I think they require full attention. And if you're a critic, you're writing down notes, you're looking up and down, you can't get into them. So that's my theory. By the way, not a knock on critics. I love critics. I read a lot of movie criticism.
I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, the Rotten Tomatoes thing, I just, Scorsese wrote a good article about that. It's like people used to hear about a movie and they'd go see it. And now they're just being told not to see all these movies. And, you know, if they get reviewed during Oscars and they're like a lowbrow comedy, they don't take seriously. So you're getting sort of misinformation. So it's kind of, you know, it's what it is. There's so much information out there that, you know, you want to have critics. But I like the old days when there was just Siskel and Ebert. You just had two guys.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, oh, these guys kind of liked it.
Yeah.
Well, one of them liked it. I like the bald guy better. Yeah. The fat guy.
I try to not even watch trailers of movies.
Me neither.
I will read reviews of movies after I've watched it to certain people whose writing I like, just to see how they thought about it and how that goes with how I feel about it. And I just think, you know, that... the Rotten Tomatoes thing is interesting, but that's why I like watching movies in movie festivals. If we have a, you know, if I get to go to a movie, I'll just go in and watch.
You have no idea what you're going to
see. No idea, because a lot of times now when you go in to see a movie, you already know whether you're going to like it or not, because you've seen the Rotten Tomatoes score, you've heard so much about it, you know so much about it, you already go in with so much. I like just going in. There's this festival called Fantastic Fest. Have you been to it?
No, I've
in
heard
Austin?
Of it.
Emily and I went for like a bunch of years in a row.
Blast.
And we just pick five movies every day.
They're all horror?
They're all genre.
Genre.
So you go in and you just like, I saw The Babadook like that. I had no
Babadook
idea.
Babadook was good. It was really well directed. It just wasn't scary enough.
It was
a good movie.
I went in knowing nothing about it. And okay. I was like, this fucking
rocks. Oh, okay. Yeah. I heard it was really scary. It was so scary. Yeah. I liked it though.
I knew nothing about it.
I feel like I'm terrible. I'm just such a hard critic.
But there's a lot of horror movies that don't scare me that I really, really love. I don't think horror really... Like, I thought that the It remake, even though it didn't scare me, I really liked it.
This has been an incredible interview.
Well, thank you for having me.
No, I really enjoyed this. You're a great guy.
Dude,
I hope to see you again.
Me.
I'm going to invite you out. Rob, did you like this?
I did.
He's such a talented guy and a nice guy. You're one of the good guys.
Oh, well, thank you, man. You too.
Kumail Nanjiani.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.